Ecclesiastes chapter 11. Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a portion to seven or even to eight, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. And if a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. As you do not know the way the spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God. He makes everything. In the morning sow your seed, and at evening withhold not your hand. For you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. Light is sweet, and it is pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. So, if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. But let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these things God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they are few and those who look through the windows are dimmed and the doors on the street are shut, when the sound of the grinding is low and one rises up at the sound of a bird and all the daughters of song are brought low. They are afraid also of what is high, and terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails, because man is going to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They're given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. Do look up. I say every week there's on the inside of your outline there'll be some pointers, some helpers, which will be a help to you as we look at the verses together. 2 weeks ago we were thinking from Ecclesiastes about the challenge of living in a world which seems chaotic, a world in which instead of bad stuff happening to bad people and vice versa, very often the opposite happens. There doesn't seem to be much rhythm or justice to it. It's a world in which, as Solomon put it back in chapter 9, time and chance happen to us all. In fact, even since that Sunday 2 weeks ago, I've heard news about two mothers I know of school-aged children, one a relative, one a friend of the family, who have recently been diagnosed with cancer, one of whom there's no prospect of recovery for. And as we look out at our lives, it just seems arbitrary so often how the world is. And Solomon knows that one of the ways we tend to respond to living in a chaotic world is that we start to live defensively. We start to live cautiously and anxiously. So yes, there are things in life we could throw ourselves into. Perhaps we can think of opportunities or dreams or ambitions, areas of service, relationships. But we think it never seems quite the right time. After all, the priority right now has to be getting that qualification, securing that job, getting that financial security, doing whatever it is which we think will shield us against whatever disasters might happen just over the horizon. And Solomon's message throughout this book has been not simply to be realistic about this life. This world is chaotic, it's fallen. But also he's been helping us to live wisely and positively in the midst of all this chaos. And in the verses we're looking at this week, he's going to show us how to live, you'll see on your sheets, generously, joyfully, and reverently in the midst of the chaos. So first of all, he calls us to live generously because life is in God's hands. So let's get into the verses. Verses 2 to 6 are all about being generous. But the argument given for why we can be generous is not one that we're probably used to. Have a look. Verse 1, cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a portion to 7 or even to 8, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth. So have a think about this argument. The argument goes like this. Life is chaotic. Verse 8, you don't know what disaster is going to come. It might be just round the corner. So what, therefore, should you and I do with our resources? Answer, be generous. And we're thinking, how does that work? That is the opposite of what most people think, what most financial advisors tell us. But here's how the logic works. Look at verse 1. If we cast our bread upon the waters, if we're open-handed, generous, we will find it after many days. God will reward our generosity. So if we're unsure about market fluctuations, this is the safest way to invest. A totally secure investment, we're told. In some ways, Christian giving isn't really the right expression. I think we should talk about Christian investing. When Paul in the New Testament explains the principle of Christian generosity, this is in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 6, he puts it this way. The point is this, whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. Whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. And it's made much more explicit in that chapter that the promise is that to the one who is giving generously, the Lord will continue to provide seed for sowing, we're told. Not for luxuries, necessarily, but seed, enough to keep being generous next time and next time. And if this is new to you, look at the same principle as well in Philippians 4 or in Galatians 6. And verses 1 to 2 here in Ecclesiastes 11 assume that principle here. God will repay generosity. We can be sure of it. So let's keep going. Verse 3. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. And if a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. The point here is that the clouds and the trees don't consult us before they do their thing. They just get on with it. We're not in control of so much that happens. But the argument is that doesn't mean we should be passive. Look at verse 4. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. Of course he's not going to reap because he's been too cautious and anxious to sow. And so this is the warning. We're not to let our ignorance about the future make us live defensively and passively. It's worth asking ourselves the question, how much does anxiety govern our lives? Yeah, that might be a logical approach, just being defensive, if there wasn't a sovereign and wise creator who holds his people in the palm of his hand, as we heard in chapter 9, verse 1. But thankfully, that is not our situation. Look at verse 5. As you do not know the way the Spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. When I studied embryology, which is the process, you know, of how through cell replication and specialization, a single fertilized cell somehow develops all its organs until it's a fully functioning fetus. And I remember coming out of a supervision some years ago and thinking, wow, that is incredible. That is wonderful in theory, but I just can't see it ever working. It's just too intricate. It's miraculous. And yet it does work often. And each of us here is testimony to the Lord's incredible wisdom and care, knitting us together into the unique individuals he's made us to be, fearfully and wonderfully made. Just look right now at your fingerprints, if you've got good enough eyesight to do that. Aren't they incredible? The Lord knows what he's doing. But verse 5 is reminding us that we don't need to know everything about what the Lord was doing at each stage in our development to get the fact that he knows what he's doing. He can be trusted. As our heading says, it's because we can trust our lives are in God's hands that we can be free to live generously. Look at verse 6. In the morning, sow your seed. Again, be generous. And at evening, withhold not your hand. For you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. He's saying, just get on with it. Be generous. I love the way Bible logic works so often. The world outside looks at the same data. It looks at an uncertain world and comes to precisely the opposite conclusions. Spending all our time clinging onto our resources, trying to protect ourselves from what might just happen, protecting our health, protecting our careers, protecting our finances. And it's all because the world outside assumes a framework where human beings are effectively on a desert island with finite resources. It's like we've got 20 cans of beans to share between us. And therefore, every can I give to you is a can I now can't have for myself, and that makes me vulnerable. And so you become my rival. And people even calculate, how cheap can I make the final years of my parents' life so that they don't consume all the baked beans? Or in marriage, at its best, it becomes, how can we come to an equal and equitable partnership on career decisions and holiday choices and every area of life so that in everything we get precisely 50% of all the baked beans, as if everyone, even our spouse, is a competitor. But the universe we actually live in has at its center an infinite triune God, whose very life and glory is that he's self-giving. He's like the sun at the center of our solar system, just pouring out extravagant blessing day after day after day. And the Lord has declared that the path to true life and blessing is to be like him, to give ourselves away. And in this universe, the one we actually live in, it's when I give myself away, when I give away my time, when I give away my energy, when I give away my money, that God brings true life and fruitfulness. So can I encourage you, we don't have 20 cans of beans to go round. We have seed, verse 6, and we have fertile soil. And every time we give away the seed, it comes back in greater number. And that's the logic here for why we're called to live generously, because we know that life is in the Lord's hands. Now, I mentioned at the beginning this temptation that we have in a chaotic world to keep waiting, to keep putting off living life to the full until that moment when we feel more secure about life. And once again, Solomon turns that logic on its head and he says, and this is point 2 on your sheets, live joyfully now because life's fleeting and temporary and insecure. Verse 7, light is sweet, and it is pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. And this is a familiar theme if you've been with us in Ecclesiastes. The big message here, once again, enjoy life. Carpe diem. Seize the day. Live large. And the reason to live like this? Well, we've seen this argument before as well in Ecclesiastes. Because life is short. Because death is coming. As we've seen before, you only live once. Make the most of it. Look at verse 8. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all, but let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart, and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. Now, incidentally, we've mentioned before in this series that I think that word translated vanity, hebel, isn't the best translation of it. Does anyone remember what it literally means? We covered it early in our series. Mist, thank you, mist. This was our visual aid, I think it was in week one. Mist, vapor. So it's the most repeated word in the book, and every time we read it, I think we should gloss and think of vapor. And there's two particular senses that we're meant to think of vapor, and it depends on the context. So very often, the idea is that something is fleeting, it's temporary. Just like that mist, it's quickly gone. Sometimes the idea is that something is hard to grasp hold of, just like mist, just like vapor is hard to grab onto. It's hard to understand. But verse 10 is another example of just how it simply cannot mean meaninglessness, as some translations put it, or vanity. Because, of course, Solomon's just been saying how precious youth is, not how pointless it is. Now, the point in verse 11 is that youth and the dawn of life are fleeting. They just don't last. Now, we've mentioned before how Christians often struggle with this kind of teaching, the kind of make the most, carpe diem sort of teaching. I recently watched a film called The Bucket List, which I can't wholeheartedly recommend. And the Morgan Freeman character in that gets told that he's dying. And immediately he concocts this list, this bucket list of things he wants to do. And he leaves his wife and his family and he heads off around the world, ticking off his various dreams and ambitions. And we think, surely that kind of selfish hedonism, that is the opposite, isn't it, of what a Christian should be called to. When Solomon teaches the young man in verse 9, walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes, we were probably thinking, surely that is not the advice you're meant to give to young people, is it? Aren't you meant to say, listen, the ways of your heart are wicked. Whatever you do, walk in the opposite direction to them. And it's a fair question. How are we to understand this teaching as Christians? But as we've seen before, Solomon is talking here to a believer. He's talking to someone who fears the Lord. Just like when Nathan, the prophet, said to King David, go, do all that is in your heart, for the Lord is with you, in 2 Samuel 7. Solomon's saying, if you fear the Lord, maybe, hopefully, some of the things in your heart will be good things. Maybe as you see that sports team to join, as you see that property to develop, as you see that godly girl to get to know, maybe those are wonderful things to pursue. If there's a course that you want to study, do it. If there's a knitting pattern you want to master, go and do it. If there's an area of ministry you want to pursue, go for it. But, verse 9, know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Don't do those things like some foolish sinner who thinks that they can get ultimate gain from them or ultimate security or ultimate satisfaction. Don't be like them. No, do it in the fear of God. Do it as a creature who is living in dependence upon God and seeing each part of our lives as a chance to love God and to know him better. So do that anthropology course, but do every lecture delighting in the Lord and in the complexity and beauty of the world that he's made. Knit that new pattern, but produce every stitch in a spirit of thankfulness to our Creator. Get stuck into that ministry, but do it in dependence on God and consciously for his glory. And supremely, verse 9, do it all looking to his well done on the day of judgment. As Paul in the New Testament tells the slaves in Colossians chapter 3, whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. Whatever we do, do it wholeheartedly. Look to his reward, his well done. And then as we read on, the following verses in chapter 12, 1 to 8, contain this beautiful poem about aging, and it gives us even more motivation to live joyfully now, precisely because life is so fleeting and insecure, precisely because we're only young once. Chapter 12, verse 1, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth. And this description of God as Creator here is a reminder. He's the one who created this good world full of things to enjoy. And so we're to live this joyful life in dependence on and bringing glory to our great God. Verse 1, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth before the evil days come and the years draw near of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Growing old. For lots of, I think particularly little boys like I was, we grow up with the expectation that one day we'll probably play centre forward for England. Probably. And then the moment comes a little bit later, we're just looking through the paper, and we notice that some of the top players are now quite a bit younger than us. And then as the years progress, there's that gradual realization that the time may be running out for some of the ambitions that we had in life. Solomon is warning us in verse 1 not to keep putting off life. So I make it sound as if I should have just gone for it and then I would be there. But not to... there were other things holding me back. Solomon's warning us not to keep putting off things in life until some vague time in the future. He's saying there will never be a day in this life when I can hear and see and exercise as well as I can today. He's saying make the most of today. Look at verse 2. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain. I think this is still talking about the end of a person's life, but now it's using imagery about the end of the world, apocalyptic language, and it's saying that every person's death is in some way like the end of creation as they experience what it is to be unmade. And next, the verses continue, and they describe the end of a person's life, but now using the imagery of a deteriorating old house. Look at verse 3. In the day when the keepers of the house tremble, perhaps that's the arms, and the strong men are bent, maybe that's talking about a person's legs, and the grinders cease because they are few, probably teeth dropping out, and those who look through the windows are dimmed, eyesight failing, and the doors on the street are shut, perhaps the mouth caving in. When the sound of the grinding is low and one rises up at the sound of a bird. And it's talking about how old people can often be light sleepers, I think. And all the daughters of song are brought low. The music's gone. Verse 5, they're afraid also of what is high and terrors are in the way. Anxiety is growing even about normal things. The almond tree blossoms, perhaps grey hair. The grasshopper drags itself along and desire fails. Sexual ability and desire diminishing. Because man is going to his eternal home and the mourners go about the streets. And this poem is assuming that death starts breaking in, it starts interrupting life even before it finally takes us. But then it comes. Verse 6. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. It's talking about that final, irreversible moment when the vessels break and the liquid escapes. And it's a picture, I think, of that moment when the body finally breaks down and the spirit escapes and returns to God. Verse 8, vapor of vapors. That's how we're going to translate it now. Vapor of vapors, says the preacher. All is vapor. Fleeting. Temporary. And all this is given here to send the message home as loudly and as clearly as possible that we are to live joyfully now, precisely because we know that life is so fleeting and because aging and death is unavoidable. It is coming. So let's think back, each of us today, about some of the gifts that we've enjoyed today. Perhaps you've had legs that work. Perhaps you've had food that tasted good. Perhaps you've seen people you love. Perhaps you've been able to show hospitality or care to someone. Well, one day we will look back on today, maybe at the end of our lives, and we will say, wow, those were the days. Those were the days. And one of the take-home messages of Ecclesiastes for me has been trying to develop the habit day by day of saying to myself the mantra, these are the days. The day we just had was the day. Don't wish them away. Value them. Give thanks for them. These are the days. I think this teaching from Ecclesiastes may be a useful corrective for some of us who sometimes feel guilty when we enjoy God's gifts in this world. Perhaps for some of us, we've rightly understood the urgency of the gospel, that nothing matters more than for people to be in right relationship with our Creator God before the judgment, and we know that. But it's possible for us to take that truth and then neglect other parts of God's revelation in the Bible and to twist it into what becomes an unbiblical reductionism that says that all that counts, therefore, is evangelism. And that reductionism can make us devalue our created physicality. And so we start treating food as just fuel. And marriage becomes either a distraction or possibly just a means of evangelistic efficiency or something like that. And our work becomes merely a place to earn money for Christian mission. And friendships become just functional and mercenary. And Ecclesiastes helpfully reminds us that in saving us, God is restoring us to our true created humanity. In fact, given that the serpent's lie from Genesis 3, we're going to be looking at that in a couple of Wednesdays' time, given that that lie was that God is mean-spirited and harsh, our job as believers is not to reinforce that lie and give the impression that God made this beautiful world only to forbid his creatures from enjoying it. No, our job is to live thankful, joyful lives, lives which point to our Creator's goodness and generosity in all things. And it's precisely because Solomon's message is so radical, not just to those of us who have this reductionist view of life, but to all kinds of religious people who think that Ecclesiastes sounds unspiritual, that it's important for us next to hear the necessary sales pitch at the end of this book. The last few verses you'll probably notice were not written by Solomon, the preacher, but they're about him, and they're written by an editor. And verses 9 to 14 are a little bit like, I think, the blurb on the back of a book. I picked a German one here so that fewer of us will spend time in the sermon reading it rather than listening to me, but I'm sure Martin probably will. But this blurb at the end of Ecclesiastes is to convince us that it's worth our while listening to this book's message. Look at verse 9. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. I guess we've found Ecclesiastes is a challenging book. And sometimes, in preparation, I've been grappling for ages with how each verse follows on from the last. And the temptation is to say, well, it must just be random, must be miscellaneous. And this verse has been an encouragement to me to keep grappling, because it says it's all been carefully arranged, we're told. Verse 10, the preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. And you can see these verses, they are a glowing five-star review, aren't they, on the back of the book. Ecclesiastes is not just beautifully written, verse 10, it's completely reliable in its message, verse 10. And that is because the message comes from God himself, that great shepherd of the sheep, verse 11. That is why, verse 12, it's all we need. We don't need to add a sequel. And goads, there in verse 11, are the sharp spikes on a shepherd's stick for prodding sheep who are wandering off in the wrong direction. And so it might be uncomfortable reading, he's saying. It's going to be like goads when we read it. But value it. It is supremely precious, because these goads are how God, the shepherd, will keep us on track. Now, it's this paragraph that explains the approach that we've taken to this book this year. I've discovered, and you may have, that lots of commentaries and maybe preaching series you've heard assume Ecclesiastes is sub-Christian. Poor Solomon, they say, if only he knew what we do about eternal life, then he wouldn't be so depressed. Well, at least he shows us, they say, how meaningless life would be if God weren't in the picture. And it's worth considering for a moment why this book needs this sales pitch at the end. I actually can't think of another Bible book that has something quite like this at its close. Why does it need it? And I take it that it's because God knows how quick we are to dismiss the message of Ecclesiastes, to think it's unspiritual, perhaps. And the writer wants us to know that, challenging as it is, this book is exactly what the great shepherd wants his sheep to hear. It's a positive message. And our final point there on the sheets comes from the final conclusion of the whole book. Live reverently, because all of life is significant. Let me read verse 13. The end of the matter, all has been heard. This is great. You get the shortcut, the conclusion. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Why? Verse 14. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. We've seen already, haven't we, even in today's verses, we saw it in chapter 11, verse 9, this teaching about a judgment day. And it is wonderful, wonderful news. If you've been with us for the series, Solomon began chapter 1, verse 3 with this question: what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? And Solomon has been opening our eyes to the fact that God has deliberately frustrated this life so that we cannot make a lasting difference in this life. He's been telling us that we're just making sandcastles as the tide comes in. But the wonderful news Solomon has been bringing us is that although we cannot produce lasting gain ourselves, we can entrust gain to God. Verse 14, God will bring every deed into judgment. Everything we do, therefore, has lasting significance, ultimately. Everything matters. Such a relief having seen him knock away the sandcastles and then to say, but life has real value and purpose because we have a God who will bring every deed to account at the end. That is what explains the chaos in our world. We can't make sense of it without this, but it will make sense ultimately. I think often when we think of judgment, we think of it very negatively, and understandably so, because of course if we face the judgment unforgiven, then of course we're in desperate danger. And please, if you're unsure about how you can be safe on that last day, please, whatever you do, don't leave here without talking to a Christian or talking to me. Please sign up for the Christianity Explored course. Do everything you can to get straight on this issue because it matters. But of course, for those of us who know we are forgiven, for those who know we are right, justified before God, the fact of judgment is then a wonderful thing. I guess we've all come across school teachers who didn't care enough to properly mark the students' work. In fact, I heard about some children who put this to the test by writing rude things about the teacher in the middle of their essay, just to see if the teacher would notice. And as soon as children work out that there's no real assessment of what they do, it is deeply demotivating. They'll just disengage. I was listening to a TED talk a while back by a professor of psychology, and he was saying that this sense that there is no ultimate assessment and therefore no ultimate meaning in life, as he saw it, is what accounts for why many people plunge into depression. It's so demoralizing to live in that kind of world. But Solomon assures us here that everything matters. Everything. And can I say, this is such a practical teaching. Even in the last 24 hours, I've taken comfort at least once from the fact that even if others don't see what I'm doing, or perhaps even if others misunderstand what I'm doing, God always sees. And as we heard in Jesus' parable that Philip was reading for us, the parable of the talents, he will always reward faithful service of him. And so Solomon's conclusion to us at the end of this book is to fear God, to live our whole lives before him in reverence. We thought at the beginning about, given the chaotic world we live in, the temptation to live defensively, to live cautiously and anxiously. And I hope we can see that wonderfully in these verses, Solomon has shown us a much better way. His liberating news for us is that reverence for God and reveling in life are not opposites. They should go together. And whilst there's no question we all live the entire length of our lives, we all live until our dying day, his call to us here is to make sure we live the entire width of our lives and to live lives of generosity and joy.